Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, episode number 39 for Monday, March 29th, 2010, celebrating women. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode, episode number 39 of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. Today, we are celebrating women because it is National Women's History Month, month of March is, and yesterday was Ada Lovelace Day. Unfortunately, the show did not air on a Wednesday, so we have to push it one day further to a Thursday, and we're going to not just celebrate Ada Lovelace and the first computer programmer, but we're going to celebrate all of women in science. And so today on the show, I'm talking with Janet White, who is joining us. She's a counselor for the National Association for Women in Science. She works in their marketing and communications, and she's also been a past president of the San Diego chapter of the Association for Women in Science. She graduated from Cambridge University in the UK in chemistry, so she's got a chemistry background, which we love. She started her career as an NMR spectroscopist at Beecham Pharmaceuticals, and she worked on antibacterial drugs. She moved into a management role and got an MBA and joined a strategy consulting firm, Arthur D. Little. She moved to Princeton, New Jersey in 2001 and joined PhysRx, then joined the Women in Science at that point in time, with the active Central Jersey chapter. In 2002, she got to move to sunny San Diego to take a position as the Director of Strategic Management at Pfizer Global Research and Development. And she immediately joined the AWIS San Diego chapter because what else is there to do? You're a woman in science. There's an association for women in science in San Diego. You join. It's great. She served as their president from 2004 to 2006, and she won an Athena Pinnacle Award in 2005 on behalf of the AWIS San Diego chapter for support of women in science, received the San Diego President's Award from AWIS in 2008 for her contributions to that chapter, and she's now going to talk with us today about women in science and the wondrous things that women have done for science. Janet, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Dr. Kiki.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about yourself and what got you interested in science initially.
Well, I come from a scientific family. So originally it was my dad. He's a professor of physics and crystallography. And I always wanted to be like my dad when I grew up. I think like so many kids do, you look at your parents. And so I was always interested from science in an early age. And then when I was at high school, I had some wonderful teachers who really, they encouraged me and they really built my curiosity and my interest about science.
And then you got into chemistry. What was the NMR spectroscopy? What was that draw for you?
Oh, well, with chemistry, I've always enjoyed cooking and eating food. And to me, chemistry is such fun because you actually get to cook up chemicals and make new molecules. And the only downside is that you can't always eat them at the end of the experiment. So I always enjoyed the creative aspects of chemistry. But I also enjoyed the more abstract and theoretical side of science, and particularly mathematics. And so NMR spectroscopy is a great scientific discipline for combining that more theoretical mathematical side with the organic chemistry and cooking up new molecules. So my job was a lot of fun. I actually had to figure out the molecular structures of new drug compounds, either ones that the chemists working in the labs upstairs had cooked up Or sometimes I got to look at natural products that our biologists had isolated from microorganisms in the soil. And that was really fun. That was real detective work using NMR spectroscopy and other techniques to figure out what these molecular structures look like.
And going from the NMR, going from lab work into the business, the actual MBA side of things, what led you in that direction?
Well, when I got my first degree, my bachelor's degree, I thought that was all that you needed to have a successful career, particularly in industry. I went straight into industry rather than staying in academia. And so I didn't take the time to get a PhD. But after I'd spent about 3 or 4 years working in industrial drug research and development, I realized that maybe that had been a mistake. And rather than going back to school and studying for a PhD, I decided that an MBA, a business degree, would allow me to move more into the management of science and not so much into actually doing the experiments in the laboratory myself every day. So that was the main driver.
So you did the actual doing the experiments in the laboratory after a while. That wasn't what you wanted to be doing so much.
That's right. Well, I think if you have a PhD, then you tend to get positions where you are designing experiments, dreaming up ways that you can address a hypothesis and directing the work of other scientists. But because I just had a bachelor's degree, I was doing fairly routine, repetitive work in the lab. And sometimes the... it was just a challenge to see how much work and how many repeat experiments you could get done in a day. And I wanted to do something that was a little bit more strategic. And so I realized I had to get a higher degree of some kind, either a higher scientific degree or a higher business degree, to get into that kind of a role.
Yeah. I think there's definitely a certain amount of that repetitive, monotonous activity in science where you just have to drive through it. And maybe someday computers will be able to do all of it, or robots, but until that happens, it's grad students and lab techs.
That's right. But I think some of the most cool stuff in science is actually working in multidisciplinary teams and groups, where you may be the expert in one scientific discipline, but you're working with people in other disciplines on a much bigger scale problem. And it's very, very interesting to learn about what the other scientists do. And it gives you a broader perspective, I think, on your own work and your own experiments.
Yeah. So getting into the topic of the broader topic of women in science and where women are in science. There was a question that was brought up in our chat room here that it says, why are there women in science? Why are we talking about women in science? Isn't science sexless? Do you have any comment to that?
Well, it's interesting. There was a report, a study done by the American Association of University Women that was reported on in the New York Times on Monday this week. And the actual title of the report is Why So Few? And it looks at, why there are so few women in senior positions, in professor, in tenured faculty positions within science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. So I think if you look at the statistics now, in terms of bachelor's degrees, undergraduate degrees, the numbers of women and men obtaining bachelor's degrees in science are almost equal. And in some areas like biology and chemistry, there are actually slightly more women who are getting bachelor's degrees. Then when you look at PhD degrees, it's still pretty good. And maybe as many as one third of PhD degrees in science are won by women. But then when you start to look at scientific faculty, the numbers are much smaller. And so, for example, the American Chemical Society does an annual survey of the percentage of women in chemistry faculty. And currently in the U.S., it's only 17% of chemistry faculty members at American universities are women. So I think it still is an issue. While we're better represented at the undergraduate level, there's still a very, very big gap in representation at the level of professors and faculty members.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to bring up, where you see a lot of women at school. If you're in a university or you're going to a college, there are definitely women in your classes. But how many of your classes are taught by women, and how many of them are full professors? There's a point between graduate school and actually going into some kind of a career in the sciences that the numbers seem to drop. And there are probably a number of reasons why that happens. You know, I just wonder how much of it has to do with role models and women actually seeing other women in those positions of responsibility.
I think there's quite a lot of that. I mean, from my point of view, there are two big factors that come into play. And one of them, as you say, is role models. And I like to think of it as a lack of self-confidence. That there have been a lot of studies done with women and girls of different ages. And often we find that stereotyping of women, the expectation that they'll be less able at science than men actually leads them to perform less well. But if you do controlled experiments where you you present different stereotypes to groups of women, they'll actually perform differently in math tests depending on what the expectation has been set. So I think a lot of it is about self-confidence, about having role models and mentors and having confidence in women's abilities in science. But the other big thing, I think, is about the nature of work for many scientists in both academia and industry, and that's challenges over work-life balance. Mm. Science is a demanding job, and often if you're in the lab, it can demand very, very long hours. If you're in industry, it can also involve long hours, lots of travel, lots of meetings. And many women find that it's just too difficult to juggle their work-life balance. And so they tend to drop off the tenure track and maybe try and take a position that allows them to have a better balanced life. And I think it applies not just to women that have children and families, but I don't have children. I have a husband, right. And I have a lot of interest outside work. And I think work-life balance is a concern to many women and to men also working in scientific fields.
Yeah, well, it definitely, having a family definitely is it's a team effort. If you are a single parent, it's definitely a difficult thing to do, and what you're able to do with your career if you're raising a family, those are definite considerations that must be taken. I'm just thinking about my own graduate school experience and who I saw and what women around me in the professorial roles at the university seemed to be doing. And there was one woman who was moving up in her department who had children. She had just, you know, gone straight through. Husband, children, degrees, just worked straight through, and she definitely had put her work and her time in to be able to get to where she was. Another woman had taken time until her 30s, 40s, raised her kids, and then gone back to school, bachelor's, PhD, and gotten a full professorship. And so by the time I met her, she was in her late 50s, but she started her career much later after she'd raised the family. And that was how she solved that problem. And then the large number of women who were my mentors didn't have families.
It's very interesting, actually. We had the board of the Association for Women in Science came and presented a panel discussion at a local conference in San Diego a few years ago, and it was very interesting. You know, these are all very, very successful, accomplished women scientists, and only a minority had children. Many of them had chosen not to have children, or some of them, the ones who said that they had the best option were ones who'd married a spouse who had an existing family of older children. So they had all the fun of a family and kids without having that early stage of raising the little ones.
Yeah.
So those are the ones who said that they really felt they got the best of both worlds, an instant family, but not the issues of childcare in those early years.
Yeah, that's definitely the consideration are those early years. But many women have done great things, whether or not they've had families in the sciences. Janet, do you have any picks for who you think have been some of the most significant female figures in science?
Wow, that's a good question. I mean, obviously, you mentioned at the beginning of the show that we've been celebrating Ada Lovelace Day.
Yes.
And she was quite amazing. She was extremely talented at mathematics. And I was reading a little bit about her online, and I hadn't realized she was actually the daughter of Lord Byron, the famous poet, And then she did a lot of her work alongside Charles Babbage. And I feel kind of a personal connection to her story, first of all, because I also went to Trinity College in Cambridge, where Lord Byron was an undergraduate. And he's notorious for having kept a bear, a pet bear, in his rooms in the college.
Oh, my goodness.
And people still talk about that today. So I feel some connection with Ada's father. But also, my dad at one time was a physics professor at King's College in London. And that's actually where Charles Babbage built his difference engine, the engine that Ada Lovelace documented so well. And the parts of his unfinished engine are still in the museum at King's College University, in the University of London. So I feel like I have some personal connection to Ada. But she was really a remarkable person. After her mathematical work, she went on to marry a British nobleman and went on to have a family. But she was quite a remarkable woman for her day. And then I think one of my personal favorites is Rosalind Franklin. Once again, personal connections. I mentioned my father's a crystallographer, and this is what Rosalind Franklin's expertise was. And also, there's been a lot of discussion since her untimely death, how she was unfairly passed over for the Nobel Prize with Crick and Watson for the discovery of DNA. And I have to say, I always have a soft spot for the underdog. Mm. And so I really feel for her, partly because I really enjoy the field of science that she worked in, but also because I think she was not recognized adequately during her lifetime for her contributions to such an important scientific discovery.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's something that's too bad. People do recognize her, and she definitely would have been recognized had she survived. You know,
yeah.
had she lived longer. But you know, that's it's unfortunate. But I think a lot of people over the last few years, I've seen her story come out more and more.
Yes.
So I feel as though people are really trying to take the story and tell the story of the work that she did and the influence that she had on determining the structure of DNA.
That's right. And actually, I read a wonderful book. It's a biography of Rosalind Franklin called The Dark Lady of DNA by Brenda Maddox.
That sounds great.
And if anyone is interested in learning more about her life story and her work, it really is a great book. I think it presents a very balanced story about her as a person as well as about her scientific research.
Yeah. Did you have any other beyond Rosalind and Ada Lovelace?
Oh, my goodness. There are so many.
I know.
if we keep on the crystallographer theme, there was another very distinguished woman crystallographer, Dorothy Crowfoot Hodgkin. And Dorothy Hodgkin, I believe, was involved in elucidating the crystal structure of insulin, which is a really important hormone. And once again, my husband has diabetes, and he doesn't take insulin yet, but I feel a great debt of gratitude to scientists like Dorothy Hodgkin, who were able to elucidate the structure of this molecule, and that's really helping us, I think, today in understanding how to treat the disease. Also, she had some connection. I remember she was still alive when I was young, and so I did meet her when I was very young. I think she visited Bristol University, so it's nice to have that personal connection. Then we've had, I think in recent years, there have been an increasing number of women scientists who are winning Nobel Prizes, and there are some of them based here on the West Coast. One I'd like to mention is Linda Buck. Linda Buck won a Nobel Prize in 2004, and her work is actually understanding our sense of smell, our olfactory sense, which is really intriguing. And then, of course, in 2009, another Nobel Prize was shared by Elizabeth Blackburn and Carol Greider, and Carol Greider is based here in University of California, San Diego. So it's really great to see more and more women scientists sharing recognition in the Nobel Prize, which, of course, is the ultimate accolade for a scientist. And then if you go on to other sectors, I'm really encouraged to see how many women scientists are now heading up major universities in the U.S. So Shirley Tilghman is a great example. She's currently the president of Princeton University, and she's been in that position since 2001. And Shirley Tilghman is a chemist. That's her background. And then we have another very distinguished woman chemist, Mary Ann Fox, who is currently chancellor of the University of California, San Diego. And Marianne Fox is also a chemist, and she's very active in the local American Chemical Society, so it's always fun to go and listen to her presenting on her work. And then also, if you look at the senior scientific positions in the government at the moment, AWIS has been really encouraged to see some women scientists elected to some of the top positions. Yeah. So we have Dr. Margaret Hamburg, who's now the commissioner of the FDA. That's a hugely influential role, especially for my industry, the pharmaceutical industry. And it's really great to see a woman in the top position. And also for NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, Dr. Jane Lubchenco was sworn in as the director of NOAA in about a year ago. So it's very, very encouraging to see women in influential positions in our universities and also in our government scientific agencies. And, of course, there are many, many women who've had senior positions in industry as well. If you think about Carly Fiorina and Hewlett-Packard, there have been other women in very senior positions in pharma companies. But I think that's been a little bit more difficult. And we have seen many of those women occupy the top spot for a while but then step down. And it's interesting, I think, to explore some of the reasons why that's happening.
Yeah, what do you think some of the reasons might be? I think that's why these changes.
I think it's very interesting, and sometimes it may come down to management style, and it's not many women make it through the glass ceiling to reach the top of corporations, and I think sometimes they have to adopt a very aggressive and assertive style to do that. But then once they're at the top, it's almost held against them. And I don't know if you've ever read studies, but quite often a man who's called assertive is praised, but a woman who's called assertive is called a bitch.
Exactly.
And it's that kind of bitch syndrome, I think. You know, it's necessary for women to get through the glass ceiling that way, but then it doesn't necessarily, it's not received so well once they get to the top. And if you look at many of the women who are now chief executives of corporations, quite often they've been the founder of the corporation, so they haven't had to fight to get to the top, and they've established quite a different kind of culture, a more, I would say, feminine culture, where they can be themselves without having to put on this very assertive and aggressive approach, and that often works much, much better, I think, with the managers and the employees in the company.
And so note to self, start my own company.
I think so. And, you know, many of the senior successful women who've been opting out of big corporate careers have gone on to found their own companies and be very, very successful.
Yeah. Do you think this goes as well for women who do get their own labs in academia? So not the corporate route, but going into academia, once you get a job and you start your own lab, I mean, that's almost the same as starting a small company.
It is. And, you know, I just read a newly published biography by Nina Schwartz, who was one of the founding members of AWIS. She's a very distinguished reproductive biologist. And her biography is actually entitled A Lab of My Own. And she describes in the book, you know, that the wonderful feeling of actually getting her own lab and being able to do things her way and to create a much more supportive culture where she could mentor other women. There's also an interesting theory coming back to the relatively low representation of women as professors and faculty members. It's a critical mass hypothesis, and basically the hypothesis goes that if you can get more than 15% of women in any particular organization, then you have enough of a critical mass that the women will feel comfortable. But if you just have one or two token women and they only represent, say, 5 to 10% of the total, they're never going to actually establish enough of a culture in which they feel comfortable to be able to thrive.
Right. So you have to hit some kind of a threshold.
They say 15% is maybe the magic number.
And so we'll see if they've actually started implementing this in universities, in companies, in different places, to see if this is something that we can look at on a large scale and do an actual analysis to see whether women are whether that number does seem to be the magic number.
I think at the moment the data is more anecdotal. So it's more in situations, you know, in case-by-case basis, women have reported feeling much more comfortable, and when they've looked at the number or the concentration of women, it's usually about 15% where that change happens. But it would be very interesting to get a bigger and more quantitative study. I know as scientists, we always like to see quantitative data rather than more qualitative and anecdotal.
Yeah, absolutely. Anecdotal data is never the data that that's where we like to start.
That's right,
with a
hunch.
Exactly. Yeah. This seems to be the way it is. Now let's go test it somehow.
Yeah. Is this really a trend or is it just an artifact?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I need to take a moment to thank our sponsor. So for just one moment, just hold on the line.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This hour of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider of audio books. And Audible.com is giving viewers and listeners of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour a free download of an audiobook if you go to their website, and they have a special website that you can visit. It's www.audiblepodcast.com/Kiki, K-I-K-I. And with that, you can download, if you go there, you can choose a book from any of their over 60,000 titles in all sorts of genres. But of course, science is where I like to start. And in my pick of the week for this week's Audible Pod, I'm not going to be able to open that up right now, but for the pick of the week for this week's Audible podcast book, I'm going to choose The Female Brain by Luann Brizendine. Now, Luann Brizendine is a researcher who has spent a lot of time looking at hormones in the brain and how they affect the brain and the body and the different sexes and behavior and psychology. And she's written a book called The Female Brain. Now, I will say there are a few caveats for me personally with the book. I don't think that everything is completely accurate, so don't take it as a gospel. But it is a very interesting look into how hormones work and their role in developing who we are and our personalities and how we come across. And I do believe that recently she also has another book, which is also available in Audible.com. The Male Brain. So you could download both of them, one free, and then if you got a membership with Audible, you could download The Male Brain as well. So there you go, audible.com. If you're interested in the free download, remember the website is audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. And with that, I'd like to thank audible.com for sponsoring this hour of TWIT programming. Thank you very much. Now, Janet, I am interested in knowing a little bit more about, you know, the strides, I guess, that women have made. So from, you know, we have a few names that that you've offered to our listeners. We've talked about some of the struggles that women are up against. We've talked about some of the successes, but and some of the cultural aspects of being a woman in science, but they've got it. I think we've made huge strides, don't you?
I would agree with you, and I'm particularly encouraged. We talked earlier about the very balanced representation of women undergraduates doing science, and I really love doing science outreach with girls in high schools and maybe even middle schools. It's really good fun, and I love going out there as a role model, showing them that you can be a scientist and you can still be cool. You don't have to be a geek, and that scientists have fun. And I think the message is really getting through to girls, and we see that girls they're participating in science fairs. They're really keen on science at school. They're going to university and college, and they're taking undergraduate degrees in science. So I would agree with you that we've made some huge strides in that area. And if you look at the proportion of women and girls doing undergraduate science degrees, it's really been climbing steadily over probably the last 20 years or so. And that's a really encouraging sign. And I think also the report I mentioned by the American Association of University Women, mm-hmm. they've looked at math abilities, and they're saying that if you look at 6th and 7th graders who score more than 700 on their math SATs, 30 years ago, boys would outnumber girls by 13 to 1. But now, it's only boys only outnumber girls 3 to 1 in scoring more than 700 on a math SAT. And I think that's a great way of measuring the progress that girls have made in these things. And I know a lot of attention has been, there have been a huge number of programs, outreach programs, special programs for girls to encourage them to pursue science and math. And I think we're really seeing that that's working. So in terms of inflow to the pipeline of scientists, you're right, we've made some tremendous strides. And also, if you look at industry, I would say probably in industry more than academia, women are very well represented at the level of intake of scientists, and also in middle management of science. But I would still say that we're very underrepresented when it comes to being heads of R&D departments in companies. It's much rarer to find a woman who's head of R&D, and much more common to find a man. But really, from the bottom up, I think we really are driving change. And the problem is moving higher and higher up the tree until it becomes difficult, because, of course, you're dealing with a much smaller sample of women who've reached high-level positions. There was a very interesting study run in June last year, reported in June last year. And in that study, they looked at whether men and women were given equal opportunity in applying for senior faculty positions at some of the top universities in the U.S. And the findings of the study were very interesting, quite controversial in a way, because it turned out that the problem wasn't lack of opportunity. It's just that women weren't applying for these senior positions. And for those women that applied, the success rate was just the same as the success rate for men who applied. So I think sometimes it does come back to that issue of confidence, self-confidence, yeah, that I mentioned, that we ourselves as women are perhaps less confident in our abilities than men are confident in their abilities, and that translates into the kind of things that we put ourselves up for.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because if you're not confident in your abilities, you're just not going to try. And maybe it is not necessarily that men are more confident in their abilities, but maybe they just don't care as much in the outcome. I don't know.
They've done some interesting studies. Apparently, if you praise, let's say you have a scientific team leader and you praise them for a good piece of work, they say typically women will always say, "Oh, it wasn't me, it was so-and-so." And men will always just say, "Yeah, that's great. You know, I'm fantastic. I did a good piece of work." And I think as women, we tend to blame ourselves when things go wrong and attribute credit to other people, where men always blame other people and take the credit themselves. And I apologize to any men who are listening.
I know. I
don't mean to stereotype, but I think these have been the findings or the trends that people have seen in some studies. And I think it's good to be aware of that as women, that we should take the credit for our successes.
Absolutely.
And we shouldn't be embarrassed to take the credit.
Absolutely. If you've done something well, you should let it be known, or at least accept that you've done it well.
That's right.
Yeah. And I think also looking at how girls and boys are doing differently in school, and girls, there was the whole a couple of years ago, Lawrence Summers fiasco, where he said, girls and boys he took from a study that seemed to indicate that girls and boys had different abilities, that boys were better at rotating objects in space, and girls were better at language and other things. And so there are these different abilities, and so he came from that, girls aren't good at math, girls aren't good at science. And what seems to be more the case, though, and I don't know if you've seen this as well, is that when girls are given the when they're kind of pushed and when they're given the appropriate fostering by teachers and by parents, suddenly the difference disappears.
That's right. I mean, there's expectation theory in I think it's psychology or is it sociology. They've done studies on teachers, and they say in math classes, teachers just unconsciously or subconsciously give more attention to the male students because they expect them to be better at math. And so if you look at, the number of times they'll speak to a student, they speak much more to the male students in a mixed class than to the female ones. So I think it's important for us to be aware that there are these biases that we're just completely unconscious of, mm-hmm. and then to try and act in a way that's more balanced.
Yeah. Dr. Mom in the chat room says that some of that attitude came from the late 40s and early 50s when women were encouraged to get back to the house in part to free up the workspace and jobs for the returning soldiers, which I think is interesting because women took up the role, many women took up the roles of working when the men were off at war during wartime, and then that changed. Do you think that is still part of the holdover?
I think it could be. I mean, I like to think that, we have made great strides, but you still hear some horror stories. And I actually kept an article from Chemistry and Engineering News, the American Chemical Society newsletter, about two women chemists from William Patterson University, and they described a hostile work environment, and it was awful. They were yelled at all the time. The professor whom they accused of the harassment got their names mixed up because he just seemed to see them as women and not as people or as staff members. And it was just a horrific story, and I could not believe that this kind of thing still goes on today. But I think you're right. Perhaps it's an older generation, and perhaps they just don't realize that times have changed and that that women have equal expectations to men.
Yeah, and now there is that definite the definite feeling, you can be or do anything that you want to. And it seems that now the hardest thing to do is figure out what you want to do and then to stick with it.
That's right. That's right. And in fact, I know that some people are now saying maybe we need to have support groups for young men because there have been so many programs and initiatives to encourage young women to do science and scholarships and special programs that now the boys are falling behind.
Which is
so
true.
That's another interesting story.
Yeah, that definitely is an interesting a really interesting story. The fact that, for so long we saw girls not going into the sciences, that the numbers were behind, and now there are far more girls going into the sciences, as you said earlier, than boys are. Or, well, the numbers, it's not far more, but the numbers are starting to shift.
Yes.
Yeah, so there needs to be, we've had the girls, let's make the girls feel strength and self-confidence and interest in science. Now let's bring it back to the boys as well. Maybe have some co-ed programs. I don't know.
Yes, yeah.
I don't know, but maybe, there is also evidence that when girls are taught in environments that don't include boys, when you have the individual sex environments, then they seem to do a lot better because the environment is different. There are classroom experiments that have, or at least observational experiments that have shown that girls do much better in an environment where they're able to sit and talk in small groups and they're able to work together and to cooperate, whereas boys are much more likely to be boisterous and stand up. And here again, the self-confidence aspect may be part of it, but it could also just be, the testosterone versus estrogen. Who knows?
Who knows? Yes, I've heard in those studies it's quite sad because while girls do better in single-sex learning environments, boys actually do better in mixed environments.
Huh.
And so what's good for the girls is actually bad for the boys. So it's really quite a dilemma. And I think it's very difficult to know how to address that. But maybe you can have a mix. You can have co-education, but then you can have special events where you separate.
Yeah, I think there are definite... there's definite room for improvement in all areas. I mean, the educational system in general, we can always change it. It's not set in stone. We can always move things around and shift them to hopefully, the end goal. Right now we're celebrating women in science because it's great to look back and see all the strong women who have gone through environments, who've been through difficult times and places where they've been able to be the only woman in an all-male environment, or, they're a housekeeper, or they're an assistant, a secretary, and they're able to get past that and be able to create something scientifically that is added to our knowledge of the world. And that's just, it's wonderful to celebrate that. But the end goal is to increase scientific literacy across the board.
Absolutely. And I think also it's more than that. It's to really build and strengthen our economy. Because science is a great way for driving innovation, and innovation brings growth. And I think the new administration has really recognized that, and they're increasing their funding for science because it is such an important driver of economic growth for the country. We have a lot of catching up to do. China is now, I think, overtaking the United States in terms of the number of scientific publications coming out. Now there are more from Chinese scientists than U.S. scientists. And so it's really important that we encourage, you know, great passion for and investment in science so that we can keep up our national competitiveness.
Yeah. Do you have... I don't know. As a representative of the Association for Women in Science, do you see the role of AWIS changing as kind of the political influence changes?
That's a great question. And you know, next year in 2011, AWIS will celebrate its 40th birthday. And so we're already looking forward to that and looking back over how far we've come and thinking about what our strategic imperatives should be going forward. And what we tend to do is we focus in two main areas. One area is continuing to change the system, but then the second area is equipping women scientists with tools that will help them to build successful careers in science. So let me give you some examples. So in terms of changing the system, in the early days, AWIS advocated hard for the passage of Title IX, and we still we provide statements and expert input to the government on various issues that impact women in science. What we're focusing on now, though, is shifted, and now we're focusing very much more on improving conditions for women in the workplace. About half our members are in academia and the other half are in industry or government or other positions. And I think we see that a common problem women scientists have in all of these employment sectors is working conditions that are not conducive to work-life balance. And so that's something that we're really advocating for strongly now. Then in terms of the second emphasis that AWIS has in equipping women with tools to manage successful careers, those kind of things, I think, don't change so much. So if you're on an academic track, it's all about providing you tools and help in understanding how to successfully apply to grants, how to build a lab, how to succeed in an academic environment. There are also many tools, for example, how to network, which is so important, I think, in all employment sectors, both in industry and academia, how to build strong networks, about mentoring, about coaching. And so AWIS is really focusing on these two areas. And some things, I think, always stay the same. And other things, particularly in changing our external environment, we have to build on the gains that have already been made because there's still improvements that can be done out there.
Yeah, we don't want to ever rest on our laurels, so to speak. There's no room for saying, hey, we did a good job, pat on the back, and just stopping.
That's right, because there are still these horror stories that you hear about, and you think, how could situations like that happen in this day and age? But sadly, they still do. So I think there's still a lot of work just to get out. You know, maybe the top institutions are now really have much more equitable policies and procedures, but maybe there are other institutions that haven't quite caught up. And so there's still a lot of work to do.
Yeah. And if people are interested in AWIS and what they're doing, where can people go to find information on it?
I would say that the first port of call should be our website, which is www.awis.org. So that's awis.org. And the website, it's a mine of information. There's all kinds of information, whether you want to know about becoming a member, joining a local chapter. We have over 50 chapters across the United States. And so there's a good chance there's a chapter near you. We've also very active on social media, particularly LinkedIn. And you can join the AWIS group on LinkedIn. And that's a great way of building up your own virtual network and a virtual chapter of other women in science that you can interact with. But I would encourage people to get involved. I've really benefited hugely from my involvement in AWIS. It's given me opportunities to learn new skills, to develop my management and leadership skills, and particularly networking. I've made many friends. I've actually got new jobs. through my connections in AWIS. And it's a multidisciplinary organization, so it reaches across all scientific disciplines and all employment sectors. And because of that, I think it can really broaden your opportunities and widen your horizons as a woman in science. Oh, and men are also eligible to join.
you don't have to be a woman. Yes.
You don't have to be a woman. And we have some male members. And the name is the Association for Women in Science. So as long as you support and promote the success of women in science, you're very, very welcome to join us as a member.
Yeah, and there are local chapters all over the United States. If you just go to the website, you can probably find something near you where there are local activities taking place. And I actually recently got a note in my email inbox from the East Bay Area chapter of the Association for Women in Science that they're having some events that actually are good for professional development and networking stuff, and that happens all over the country. These organizations, these local chapters, put on all sorts of great events. Is there anything happening down in San Diego right now, Janet? Are there any events coming up?
We do. We have a wonderful event coming up. I think it's on May the 6th. It's our annual scholarship gala. So every year the local San Diego chapter awards a number of scholarships to young women who are studying for degrees in science, technology, engineering, or mathematics. And the only criterion is they have to be studying in a San Diego academic institution. And we're going to have a wonderful event. It's going to be at the Science Museum in Balboa Park in San Diego. And we'll have a reception, networking, cocktails. And the highlight of the evening will be the presentation of the scholarships to the lucky winners. So that really is a great event. It's our flagship event for the year. And you can find out more information about that on the chapter website, which is AWISSD for San Diego .org. So that's www.awissd.org. And there's more information about that event there.
Great. I think that'll be fantastic. There have been also, getting back to the women in science that we want to celebrate and the reason for celebration today, there have been, let's see if I can get past my email inbox. There it is, everybody. Say hello. I got lots of suggestions from people on who they think would make a woman to celebrate. And Gord McLeod via Buzz said that Jane McGonigal is his suggestion for a woman in science because she actually shocked his design sensibilities to the core with the pure potential of game design, of games, and of gamers to change the world in real and meaningful ways. He'd never thought of game design as any kind of a scientific endeavor until he watched her talk. And there is a video on TED.com of a talk that she gave at a TED conference. That's Jane McGonigal, who is a game designer. Also, Daniel Messer said that Linda Morabito, or whatever she's calling herself these days, should make a good suggestion for a woman in science to celebrate. Linda A. Morabito, according to Wikipedia, also known as Linda Kelly, Linda Hyder, and Linda Morabito Meyer, is the astronomer who made the discovery of volcanic activity on Io, a moon of Jupiter, on March 9th, 1979, at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And then there were several votes via Twitter. Yesterday I asked a bunch of people through Twitter who they thought was their favorite scientist, and there were several votes for Marie Curie or Maria Slodov. I can't say the middle. Slodovos. Curie. It's Polish, and I completely mispronounced it, I'm sure. Ellen Saar says radioactive Polish physicist trumps all. And again, also Rosalind Franklin got several votes. Jane Goodall as well is a huge inspiration for many women and men around the world. Her research into chimpanzee behavior in the wild is it was revolutionary. Lisa Randall in physics, she's a modern female physicist who is doing some wonderful, wonderful thinking on string theory. Theoretical physics is kind of it's an interesting, interesting realm. You just get to think and come up with ideas, and she's come up with some great ones. Some other suggestions: Grace Marie Hopper, a naval officer and computer scientist. She set the standards for modern computer programming languages. Donna Lacroix, for her study of the paranormal world around us. Someone else said that their wife was their favorite female scientist out there. Kay Berensmeyer, she studies paleontology and taphonomy. Christian Nuslin Volhard, I don't know who she is. Christiana, probably a wonderful woman in science. Frequently ignored and sometimes trivialized, Mileva Marek, scientific workforce behind Albert Einstein's thought process, which I believe is something that maybe there's a story there that needs to be told. David Broadbeck says Sarah Shuttleworth, and after that, Brenda Milner. Sarah Shuttleworth actually is highly influential in my own graduate work, so I'd like to personally also celebrate her, and Brenda Milner for her studies of memory on, I think it was her studies of memory on HM. Andruyan, Andrea Ghez, Pamela Gay, Carolyn Porco, and Danica McKellar, Liz Blackburn. Even before the Nobel Prize, she was somebody to celebrate. So as you can see, the list goes on. Janet came up with many, many, many names herself earlier in the show, and I'm sure there are many more women out there to be celebrated. And I just like to ask you all to take a moment to think about the woman in science in your life, past, present, future. Is there a woman out there who you can celebrate and say nice things about? It's always nice to say nice things about these women. Janet, do you have any final thoughts on this subject?
I just echo what you say. It's great to celebrate women in science and their accomplishments, and let's look forward to many, many more in the future.
Yes, let's look forward to many more women in science in the future doing amazing work. And hopefully someday this won't be, maybe someday it won't be something that we specially celebrate separately from men in science. But, you know, it's always nice to have a celebration. So with that, I would like to say thank you, Janet White. Thank you very much for joining me on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour today, and for all the information on women in science and the Association for Women in Science, and for celebrating women in science on this date with me today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a wonderful evening.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And that was Janet White from the Association for Women in Science. And I'm Dr. Kiki, and I believe this is getting me to the end of my show, the 39th episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. Next week, I promised last week that it was going to be this week, but now this week it's going to be next week. We're talking with Dr. Daniel Everett about life and language in the Amazonian jungle. He's written a book called Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes. And the This Week in Science book club is actually reading the book. It's been the book of the month for the month of March. And March is almost over. At the very end, we're getting into the beginning of April on April 1st next week. But we're going to be talking with Dr. Everett about the book, about his research experiences, and also about his controversial, maybe not so controversial, but very upending ideas for the field of language research. So I hope that you will join me next week for that interesting conversation. You can find me at kirstensanford.com. You can email me at drkiki@twit.tv. That's drkiki at twit.tv. And where else? You can also find me if you want to download past episodes of this show. You can find me in iTunes in the Twit Network, or you can go to twit.tv/kiki. And you can find me on Twitter at Dr. Kiki. So tweet me later. Is there anything else that I need to send you to? I don't think so. There's so many places out there. You can Google me. The information is out there. It's all there. And I will see you next week. Thanks for tuning into my Science Hour. All I ask is just 1 hour a week. And really, with just 1 hour, 1 hour a week makes your world a whole lot more interesting. A whole lot. So thanks a lot.